Hi, heroes. This is Stan Lee coming at you. Want you to know, Marvel has always been and always will be a reflection of the world right outside our window. That world may change and evolve, but the one thing that will never change is the way we tell our stories of heroism. Those stories have room for everyone, regardless of their race, gender, religion, or color of their skin. The only things we don't have room for are hatred, intolerance, and bigotry. That man next to you, he's your brother. That woman over there, she's your sister. And that kid walking by, hey, who knows? He may have the proportionate strength of a spider. We're all part of one big family, the human family, and we all come together in the body of Marvel. And you, you're part of that family. You're part of the Marvel universe that moves ever upward and onward to greater glory. In other words, Excelsior!
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, we, of course, are going to be looking back on the life of the legend, the godfather of Marvel Comics, the late Stan the Man Lee. And I was thinking to myself, who better that I know to talk to than somebody who has actually interacted with him, who's loves him as from a fan's perspective, but also had to deal with him on a professional level. And I thought, why not bring in the big guns and call in my friend Kevin Boyd. Kevin, welcome back to the show, and thanks for doing this with us.
Hey, Eric, glad for having me on again. Happy to talk about Stan. I mean, who doesn't love Stan, to be honest?
Right? How could you not? How could you not love something about Stan, right?
And his loss is definitely being felt in the comics community and around the world and other communities too.
Absolutely.
All week.
Yeah. So, I mean, naturally we're going to be a little bit more somber on this episode, just reflecting back on him and thinking about, when I was told about it, it was Monday right away, someone called me, and then a flood of phone calls were coming in because everyone, I guess, wanted to tell me that it was almost like my grandfather died, I felt like, and I posted that on Facebook because I was getting all of these people calling me. And at first, I was kind of like, well, you know, the gentleman was 95 years old and he wasn't well, so this was kind of expected. But as the day wore on, it really started to sink in, and I got, choked up a couple times. Where were you when you heard the news about it?
I was at work, okay. And my colleague from the conventions, Constance, she was in Florida. She just messages me three words. She says, "Oh my God," and then silence. And then I'm like, "Oh, what happened? Did something happen awful?" And she's like, "Yeah, Stan died." So I went online, and sure enough, there was confirmation that he had just passed away. And the news went out very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, he went into the hospital in the morning, and I think everybody knew just shortly after lunch that he'd passed on. So whoever was with him got that word out very quickly.
Yeah.
And I imagine that was probably JC, his daughter.
Yeah. What was your initial reaction?
I don't know. It was a surprise. You know that the day is going to come. I mean, Stan was not a young man.
No.
He's in his 90s. I always knew that at some point it was going to happen, because the last time I saw him, he did not look well. Looked very frail. And I know he had some issues over the last couple of years, last year in particular, since his wife died. So I was very worried about him. I was like, will he make it through the year? I'm not sure. So I was just kind of taken by surprise. It was like one of those mixtures of, and there's a little bit of relief in there too, because he did have a very stressful year.
Yeah, and you were hearing, not so great things in these last couple, this last year, these last couple months especially, and you, makes you sad to see him, like in 2016, I think was his last Fan Expo in Canada.
Yeah.
And I went to his panels there, and, you know, when someone says, you know, this is the last time I'm going to be coming to Canada, you know, kind of the writing's on the wall that that might be the last time you see them. But to hear that he was kind of in bad, going through some bad times, kind of broke your heart, and you didn't want him to keep living that way.
Right, and he did, he did a bunch of shows for us after he appeared at Fan Expo Canada. That, I think in 2017, he decided that he didn't want to cross the border for reasons that I completely understand. I mean, it's a long flight.
Sure.
To go from LA to Toronto, like 5-6 hours. And, you know, flights, you know, can play havoc with an older person's equilibrium and their sleep cycles and things like that.
Sure.
And so I think he kept it to, like, short flights to conventions that he could get to within 2 to 3 hours from home.
Yeah.
So he did come across for our Tampa show. That was the last show that we had him in. And
okay.
That would have been September of 2017.
Okay.
We had an event there, too. I mean, he actually wasn't scheduled to be there, but there was a major hurricane in Florida that year. And he actually volunteered to come out and help raise money with auctions. Which he did. They actually raised over $30,000 for hurricane relief down there.
Wow, that's great.
That year. But he himself, I mean, he loved doing the auction. He was very happy to see Kevin Smith, but I could definitely see he was exhausted, and the idea of signing a lot of books, and, mm-hmm. you know, they had to keep his signings to very short periods, and the same thing with his photo ops and so forth. He looked very tired.
Sure. I mean, I'm tired, and I'm not even close to that age, just going through the daily grind of a work week. I can't imagine a person 95 years old where everybody's just clamoring for you all the time, right?
But, true, but, you know, the Stan, I mean, all my interactions with Stan over the years, he drew something from fan love.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to call him a bit like an emotional vampire, and, you know, people would see him, and he'd be like, they'd be like, Stan, or Stan the Man, or, oh my God, it's Stan Lee. And he'd perk right up, and he'd be like, how are you, Excelsior?
Yeah.
You know, he'd just, like, he'd play into the crowds. And so I think he did draw a lot of energy from people, and just from giving people love and getting that love back.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. So you've interacted with your fair share of comic book legends from organizing shows for so many years. Like, we're talking the Mount Rushmore of comic book legends, like Will Eisner. Who else? Give us a list of some of the people that you had the privilege of interacting with.
Oh man, it's a long list. I mean, I think I could, it's more like who I haven't interacted with.
Right.
I didn't get a chance to meet Kirby, and Ditko hid himself from the world many years ago.
Right.
So I never had to got a chance to interact with him or with John Buscema. Oh. But I've met, you know, Todd and Frank Miller and Sal Buscema and Steranko and a number of the other legends. I'm trying to think of a name. And we had John Byrne this year.
Right.
Met Terry Austin, Chris Claremont, Jim Starlin, Marshall Rogers, Marv Wolfman, Len Wein.
Yeah.
Neil Adams. The list, I could just keep going on,
yeah.
and on over the years. At some point, I've met just about everybody who's been around. You know, I did get to meet Gene Colan before he passed, and I met Jim Aparo before he passed in the early 2000s. So, you know, there is a lot there. There's a lot of history. I met some of the Golden Age creators as well, like Irwin Hassan, and I could keep going on, and this, my memory's not that, it's good, but it's not that great.
Well, the list is so long, like, how could you remember them all? But when you think of people, like, there's a few names that come to mind, like a Will Eisner, Steve Ditko, Jack Kirby, and then, of course, you've got Stan Lee, who I think that's a safe list of people that you would put on, like, a definite Mount Rushmore of comics. And
oh yeah, John Romita. I met John Romita as well.
There you go. There you go. There's always someone you're forgetting, but, like, those are the names that are the, when you think of modern comics and the people who really forged it. Of course, there's a few others. I'm forgetting. I don't mean to. But what was it like for you, first of all, as a fan, the first time that you met Stan Lee?
Hmm. Well, the first time I met him would have been 2004. We were going, of course, everyone's reminiscing of when they met Stan.
Yeah.
And how they interacted with him. So I had gone down there with Peter Dixon from Paradise Comics. Yeah. We flew down there to help out and get signatures at the Wizard World Long Beach convention. And I think it was the first one they were having. And Stan was appearing there for the Hero Initiative. Now, at that point, Stan really only did conventions locally. You know, he used to appear all the time at conventions, and then he kind of stepped back a bit for a while. So he would appear occasionally for Hero Initiative to help raise money for other creators in need. And so in this case, he was there to sign and raise money for the charity. So we were asked by the charity to help escort Stan from the hotel to the convention. And that's when I got a chance to sit down with him in the lobby for a little while beforehand. So he didn't talk too much to us, but he had some friends with him, and he was chatting up and talking about comics and the history of comics and things like that. So it was just great to be a fly on the wall.
Sure.
In that first conversation. And then we were security when we walked over and brought him in. And we get in an elevator, and the elevator door, someone says, "Hold the elevator," and Kevin Smith runs in and joined in. And so, again, another fly on the wall moment when Kevin Smith and Stan Lee are sort of going, and they're both geeking out for the fact that they really appreciate and admire each other.
Yeah. Their relationship was really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, who could forget that scene from Mallrats when when Brody talks to Stan about superhero genitalia and things like that.
That's right.
Just great stuff. And then, so we got to hang out with him a bit at the signing. I actually posted a picture on my Facebook wall. Someone actually found a picture from that convention and sent it over to me. So I'm like, wow, who's this stranger looking back at me from 14, 15 years ago? And then, you know, from then on, it was like we would see Stan every so often at conventions. And at the time I was doing conventions with Peter at Paradise, and we had invited Stan to come to Toronto in 2006. And we offered him what at the time was a record-breaking amount of money to come to Toronto. And then something happened and he couldn't come. So that was unfortunate. But he did send a video, and that's one of my missions this weekend, is trying to find that CD-ROM which has his video on it. Where he apologized for not being able to come to Toronto that year. We actually showed it a few times at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
Just to sort of say, yes, we did have Stan Lee at one point.
Yeah.
And it's a great interview. He talks about his time working in comics in the 1950s before the Marvel age sort of steps in. And he talks about working with his favorite artist, who was Joe Manili.
Hmm.
Who was the late Joe Manili, who's very talented, but often forgotten, unfortunately. But he did a lot of comics for Atlas at the time, including a short-lived Black Knight comic, which is just beautiful to look at.
Hmm.
Sort of the Greek grandfather of the Marvel comics, superhero Black Knight.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Then when I left Paradise and went to work for Fan Expo, I actually went down to Pittsburgh and helped out at a VIP event. And it was there that I was talking to Stan's representation, and we actually made the arrangements for Stan to come to Fan Expo for the first time in 2010.
That's great.
And then he was a staple. He was there.
Yeah.
Did five Fan Expos between 2010 and 2017.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. What was it like dealing with, like, when he would come here and you were on the other side of or having to organize it? Did you get a chance to interact with him a little bit more, or was it still very like, we're the handlers and you talk to us type of thing?
He has a lot of people who work with him, so they'll say what he wants and what he wants to do, and in some cases, I booked the comic guests, and I deal with a lot of the comic guests at the various shows. And at that time, I was when I made the initial contact and management made the deal with him. I was the Canadian comics guest relations person, so I mostly dealt with local guests and the bigger Canadian guests.
Okay.
So I didn't get a chance to interact much with Stan, other than, you know, get some comics signed from him. So I did have some time in the back room getting autographs.
And what was he like from, like, you saw him on the elevator with Kevin Smith or sitting with his group of friends talking comics? You were that fly on the wall. Was there, does he have that switch that he turns on and becomes like the Stan Lee that we all know, as opposed to the one that you see him in those more normal moments, I guess?
Definitely. I would also almost compare it to, I think of Rocky.
Okay.
I think of, you know, that quiet moment of solitude where you're, like, getting ready and you're gearing up and then the doors open and you run into the crowds.
Right.
Stan was very much like that. So when he wasn't on, he was, like, quiet and, you know, when do I get to go home? What time is dinner? You know, the type of normal questions that you would have. Right. And then the doors would open and it would be like, I'm the man. Or, you know. Stan, I love your work. Awesome. Send me a check. You know, like he would just sort of say these things, and it was like it literally was like turning on a switch.
Right.
But he had so much energy and so much enthusiasm when he was out in the public.
Right.
And he loved doing what he did.
So, for you, let's talk as fans now. Like, you grew up actually reading a lot more Stan Lee comics than I had the opportunity to. There isn't a book on my Marvel shelf that doesn't have some sort of Stan Lee stamp on it, because he basically created everything, it feels like, or co-created, I should say. So what was, for you, from a fan perspective, what did Stan Lee mean to you?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I was born in the very late 60s, so by the time I started reading comics, Stan had pretty much retired.
Right.
And he was off in California making the deals to get Marvel characters into TV and movies. So Marvel was very good in the 70s at reprinting the classic material. I think they knew where their bread and butter was.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the new comics were coming out and they were very good, they reprinted, like, they had stuff like Marvel Tales and Marvel's Greatest Comics. They reprinted the classic Stan Lee and Ditko, Spider-Man and Stan Lee and Kirby, Fantastic Four. So I got to read a lot of that stuff concurrently with the new material. So I really loved the older stuff. And there was a book that came out in 1976, which I think affected a lot of people, which was The Origins of Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically on the front, it's a typewriter with a pair of hands.
Yeah.
And flying out of the typewriter on the paper are the big Marvel superheroes. And the perspective is, Stan's like, well, I wrote all these stories, so I'll tell you a little bit about the classic, and then I'll show you a more modern version of the character, which was a perfect introduction for most fans in the 70s.
Right.
And then shortly after that, we saw a flurry of reprint collections, Fantastic Four and Doctor Strange and Spider-Man, and then they did pocketbook-sized reprints of the classic material. So everybody just sort of devoured that stuff and loved it.
So in your, like, what is your earliest memory of this guy, Stan Lee? Like, I know every generation has their idea of who he is or what he sounds like. What was it like for you at that age?
So I was vaguely, I mean, of course, I was aware of who Stan was because every comic had Stan Lee Presents on it.
Right.
Every Marvel book. And then his name would be all over the bigger productions too. So when Superman went Spider-Man, he was involved in some level on that, and the big treasury size editions and things like that.
Yeah.
But Stan, the person, really comes to me around 1978-79 with Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The cartoon, because he was the narrator.
Right.
So that voice, and you just can't forget that voice. It's like, hey, true believers, you know? Oh, favorite web swinger. And it's like it's the dialogue from the comics. It's that patter. It's that hip, I want to say hipster or almost hip lingo. It's not quite.
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, every character has an affectionate nickname.
Yeah. That swinging 60s sort of thing that he brought to it.
Yeah, like, and every creator, of course, had a nickname as well when he was there in the bullpen. But I think that one of the things that he was really great at was setting up that clubbiness of Marvel Comics. That as a fan of Marvel, you weren't just a reader; you were part of the club.
Right.
You were in the Marvel Universe, and it was yours to play with, and so I think that was that. It was like once you figured out who Stan was, and then you'd see him on TV more often.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were, the Incredible Hulk was big on television at the time, and Spider-Man had some TV stuff, too. And,
that's right.
You know, with Nicholas Hammond, and he was firing ropes from his wrist and stuff like that. It looked kind of weird, but it was still fun. He still devoured it because it was Spider-Man. It was
sure.
Mm-hmm. And then I think he also recorded something for some episodes of the 60s Spider-Man show as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think there was one or two episodes where it was like, "I'm Stan Lee, and I'm here to tell you about the origin of Marvel." Or origin of Spider-Man. So yeah, I think he narrated the Spider-Man origin episode. And, you know, little things like that. So he'd be around. So he was like, who is this figurehead, this mysterious person that, you know, you get the sense that he's like the father of Marvel, even though, like, as you explore and you learn a little bit more, he was definitely involved, but there were many other people involved as well.
Mm-hmm.
Adding a lot. So we can't just forget about Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko. They certainly added so much to those early Spider-Man stories. And Fantastic Four and Thor and Hulk and Iron Man and everyone else.
Yeah. So. Let's talk about that for a second, because I think there's a, you know, when people think of Marvel, whether it's the layman or, you know, the casual comic book fan, you say Stan Lee, and they, some people even thought he still, like, he owns Marvel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about that era of the birth of the Marvel Universe as we know it, because you mentioned a bunch of creators, mm-hmm. you know, Ditko, Kirby, guys who, before they were doing Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four and all of that stuff, they were comic book artists, and later on they continued to be comic book artists to the day that they died. But there was something special about 1961 when Kirby mm-hmm. and Lee created the Fantastic Four. So can you explain to the fans what exactly, or who exactly Stan Lee was at that time?
Well, so Stan... was basically, he was actually related to the owner of Timely Comics,
right?
By marriage, and he was brought in when he was 16 years old as a sort of a copy boy who worked in the office. But he really wanted to become a famous writer, and so he did actually start out. I think one of the early Captain America comics, he has a text story in it.
That's right. Yeah, I heard about that.
And World War II comes around, and he goes into the military for a short period of time. And at the time, because of his experience with comics, he ends up working in the sort of the media division of the army, and he does produce some comics for the troops, some text pieces, working with famous creators like Will Eisner,
mm-hmm.
and then there were some filmmakers as well attached. Like Frank Capra and Walt Disney and so forth, who were doing shorts and contributing to the war effort. And so he was involved in that level. But he came back and had an office job waiting for him at Timely Comics. And the business was changing, so they gradually were moving away from superhero comics. And I would say, you know, Timely wasn't the biggest company on the block at the time. They did a lot of crime and then a lot of horror and science fiction and monster comics, westerns and models and all sorts of stuff. It was almost like if there was something that was popular, Atlas or Timely would do like a knockoff version of that popular character.
Right. They were like the number two of everything.
More like the number five or six.
Okay.
they weren't the top, but they did have... They had a presence, and at one point, Martin Goodman had flooded he tried to flood the distribution titles channels with a lot of titles, and at that time they were really controlled by DC, by National,
right?
And so they kind of slapped him on the wrist and said, "No, you know what? You have 8 spots, so you can distribute 8 comic magazines a month," and that was it. So they, for the late 50s, that was it. They could only do 8 comics. And at one point, Martin went into the office, and Stan was editor, pretty much in charge. Like, he used to work with, like, when he first started, Kirby and Joe Simon were there, and other great creators. And they gradually moved on and moved out to other studios. So by the time the 50s come around, he's pretty much working with, you know, people that he recruits out of art school, like Steve Ditko or Joe Manili, people who are sort of trying to make a name for themselves in the industry. John Romita worked very briefly there before moving on to other things. And so when but he would hire them to do stories. Like, he would inventory a lot of those stories as well. So he basically had a closet where they stored the inventory stories, the stuff that hadn't been printed yet. And at one point, his cousin-in-law, Martin, came in and said, "What's this closet full of stuff, full of stories? What are these paper? Is this old stuff? Like, we should move this out." And Stan was like, no, that's all inventory material. And he says, "Then why the heck am I paying to make new comics when I have a closet full of comics that I can already print up?" Mm-hmm. So he kind of freaked out on Stan, and Stan had the unenviable position of having to let all of his friends and associates and all the people he worked with at Marvel go. And at one point, it was basically Stan and a receptionist that was shared with the magazine division. And so Stan would just assemble the comics based on what was in the inventory. And he had extra covers, and he'd do all this stuff. So for a while, Stan was pretty much the only person, and maybe a production guy, that were putting together the magazines. And so they put together 8 titles a month, and there wasn't a lot of new material in them because it was all old stuff that had been sitting in a closet. And, you know, eventually the DC had their big Silver Age revival in the mid-50s. And, you know, the new Flash was a huge hit, and Green Lantern was a huge hit, and Justice League was a smash. Like, the kids loved the Justice League title.
Yeah, sure.
And there's a famous story where someone from DC was golfing with Martin Goodman.
Was it Jack Leibowitz, they say?
It was probably Jack Leibowitz, yeah.
Is that story true? I hear people say, oh, it might not have even been true.
I think it's enough to say that Justice League was making waves and was selling so well that there's probably a little bit of boasting somewhere, whether it was on the golf course whether it was in the club or in the pub down the street.
Yes.
Because they often all ended up in the same place to drink and eat dinner. There were a couple of clubs in New York where the comic creators and editors all sort of congregated. And so Stan was tasked with coming up with something to take the old superheroes and revive them for a new generation. Because, you know, they had the Human Torch and Submariner and Captain America and so forth. And so Stan was like, oh, God, do I really want to just do that? I'm so tired of this whole business. It's such a drudgery. Like, I don't know if I want to do it. And his wife apparently said, Joan, who he's married to for 60-some-odd years, she said to him, listen, you know what? You want to write novels. You want to get into this. Why don't you give this one last go and write something fun that you want to tell? Like the way you want to do it. And so I think at that point he thought about it and he called up Jack Kirby, and the two of them hammered out what would be the Fantastic Four. And it was like dropping a nuclear bomb on the comic industry because it was so unique and so different when it was published.
Right.
And, you know, if you look at those early Fantastic Four issues, they're crude. They don't have costumes. They have powers, but they're like spinning out of the monster division. And right. And I think I kind of skimmed a little bit of the history there, but just before they had run through the inventory stuff, they did have a couple of new titles which were filled with monsters, basically. Mm-hmm. Like
Kaiju, and there was the right?
Sorry?
Kind of like Kaiju. They were big on that for a little bit.
Yeah, they were very much like the predecessors of the Kaiju and Godzilla. They were what we affectionately call underwear monsters. So okay. you'd have like a giant dragon, and he'd be wearing shorts. Okay. You know, because of course you can't have naked monsters on the cover.
Right.
And they all had like names like Gargoom or Fin Fan Foom or like all sorts of crazy names. And there were these crazy 8-page stories, like morality lessons, where like someone would find an alien vessel and they'd be ranting and raving about it, and they're like, people are not understanding them. And then it turns out that they are the alien, and they hit their head and they were confused.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, little turnabout things that would later on show up in the back of comic magazines as like what if stories.
Right.
With the Watcher, like sort of unknown stories, and they would be in like Strange Tales and Tales of Suspense and so forth. And those did well for a while, but once the superheroes caught on, it was like, okay, Kev, what can we do next? So you get, within a span of a year, Fantastic Four is a big seller, so they bring in Thor.
Was that the next thing after Fantastic Four?
Yeah, I'm not sure which was the first to come right after Fantastic Four. Thor was very early, as was the Hulk and Iron Man. And, they did do the Spider-Man one-shot in 63, and it was sort of a test. Because that title, Amazing Fantasy, was going to be canceled, so he needed a throwaway story for it. So he said, I'm going to tell another type of superhero story that I want to, he'd been developing a character, like a teenage character with Kirby, and he didn't care for it too much. And then he gave it to Ditko, and Ditko came back with what was basically the Spider-Man that we're familiar with.
Right.
And so they did they actually did one or two stories, and Amazing Fantasy was canceled. And they thought, well, you know what, the numbers came in 3-4 months later, and they're like, people like this, let's bring the character back and do something with him. And that's when Spider-Man got his own magazine. But a lot of the characters too, because they had only 8 titles, they could only give them half a book.
Right.
So you'd have like Ant-Man in the pages of Tales of Suspense or Tales to Astonish, I should say. And so they needed another character to go in there. And the Hulk wasn't that popular, so they decided to revive him in Tales to Astonish. And he ended up being even more popular in the second go-around.
Right, because he had first six issues.
All sorts of little things.
It was first six issues of the Hulk that it never really took the way that maybe they had hoped. And then it kind of had a revival a little bit.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you read those six issues, they're all over the map.
Right.
I mean, there's definitely the Hulk that we're familiar with is in there. But it starts out where he's more of like just a big, strong, grumpy guy.
Right.
He's kind of like, he talks a bit like Kirby. He talks a bit like the Thing.
Okay.
And, and he only turns into the Hulk at night. And then later on, I think Ditko comes in around 4 or 5, and he starts adding his 2 cents in. And he's like, oh, forget this day and night thing. Let's just have it anger-based. Like, when he gets angry, he becomes the Hulk. And they're like, oh, that makes more sense. And then they used him in the Avengers for a little while. And, the Avengers was great because it was a vehicle to bring back Captain America. And, the Human Torch was loosely based on the Golden Age character initially.
Right.
At least on the visual design. But, of course, he was an all-new character because he was a teenager. But the name had recognizability to fans.
Right.
Of superhero books. So, and at that time, comics were very generational. So a lot of the kids who would have read the initial Marvel superheroes in the 40s wouldn't have any. The kids in the 60s would have almost zero knowledge. But they would go and hunt them. There was also a growing trend of people would go and hunt used comics and in old bookstores, and that was sort of the genesis of our collecting frenetic base that's developed over the last few decades. So
I want to just mention something about Kirby and Stan, because Jack Kirby was also, before he had come back to Marvel, he had created some things for DC Comics, and I had heard someone mention that the Fantastic Four was basically almost, not a ripoff, I'm not going to use that word, but it was almost like Jack doing Challengers of the Unknown again, but for some reason now, it had a lot more, there was a lot more to it than just, explorers having something happen to them. the Fantastic Four, there was the familial aspect. There was the possibility of them being monsters as opposed to just superheroes. There's that fine line of something bad happened to them, but now they got special powers. So what what do you think it was? Because there's always that debate of Kirby was the, you know, he was the one making the world and drawing and designing and coming up with this. But there's something to be said about what Stan and him did together. What would you say that was?
Well, I would say there was magic there, at least at the start. Challenges of the Unknown is a well-drawn comic, but it's not the most exciting book.
Right.
You know, it's basically four plain Jane guys, you know, like Jim and Tony and Rob and John. That's not really their names, but you pick the most generic name guys and you throw them in together in a group and they go and explore caves and they find monsters and they do other things. And the book didn't really take off because it wasn't superheroes at the time were the big thing. So it wasn't a huge hit. And Kirby was known to rehash ideas. If he liked an idea and it didn't take off the first time, he would go back and retool it. Or if there was someone who gave him an idea and it didn't work out in one way, he would reinvent it. Because like his initial attempt at Spider-Man is very much like a character called the Fly that he did for Archie.
Right, okay.
So, you know, you'll see a lot of similarities and things. And that, of course, that character was also very much like Captain Marvel, the Shazam character that people are more familiar with now, since Stan would later co-opt Captain Marvel for his own characters. But, you know, like, there was an attempt to try things, and if it didn't work out, you retooled it and you brought it back. And I think Stan, like maybe Jack went and said, I have an idea. We'll put four adventurers together and then we'll spin, because I like that idea with challengers. And then he would say, well, you know what? We need something. You know, we do monster comics, so let's make one of the characters a monster. And then, you know, we do have the old superheroes we can draw from, so why don't we take that Human Torch and make him a kid, make him a teenager instead. And then... you know, little things like that. So you could sort of build out. And then he said, all right, we'll have to have a father figure, you know, pipe smoking leader, smart guy. And so let's make him a little bit younger. Let's make him, you know, the monster guy's best friend. And we'll have him go into space. And they, you know, we have to figure a way to give them powers. So let's have cosmic rays give them powers. And to me, that's like a Stan idea. Like, what are we going to do? Okay, we'll send them to space and something mysterious gives them superpowers. And then Jack would go, all right, cool. What are the powers? Let's go from there. And apparently the two of them, when they did plotting and their brainstorming sessions, they were very dynamic.
Right.
With one of the two of them on top of tables, and they would act out the parts, and and there's genuine love. I think they really do. They really were friends, and they actually did develop a lot of these ideas together.
They had to be with all of the stuff that they were creating at that pace, and having to even just with the limited amount of shelf space with eight books, but they were cranking out so many different stories. There had to be a respect. And an enjoyment to be doing this initially, at least. So, like, I would have loved to be a fly on that wall, seeing the two of them on tables coming up with stuff. Two men in their 40s.
But I think, too, like, even coming up with eight titles a month, where Stan was the primary writer on the majority of them.
Yeah.
He had to come up with a way to turn out those stories quickly.
Yeah.
And that's where we get the developer of the Marvel method.
Yeah.
Where he would come up with a plot with the artist, and then the artist would draw it and come back, and then Stan would dialogue it, coming in to see what they did. And the thing with Ditko and with Kirby was that they ended up both deciding that they didn't need Lee as part of the process because they didn't always agree with his stories.
Right.
And where they would take things. So they would basically go back and produce a fully completed issue and drop it off, and they would put their notes on the margins and say, this is what we think that happens here. You know, Jack would write in his idea of what the dialogue would be, And then Stan would come back and would write. And it would be Stan Lee, definitely Stan Lee dialogue. It would be 100%. Crazy terminology. It would be funky things going on. It would jokes happening. But it was all around that great artwork.
Yes.
So he was still, like, you know, it's one of those things where when those artists went off and did their own things without Stan, they didn't reach the same levels of success, and those comics aren't as classic.
Yes.
As the Marvel stuff that they did with him. So I think there was something too that, like, I wouldn't say Midas touch, but there was definitely a formula that worked.
Yeah, and it's important that you say that, because I think a lot of people are like, you know, Stan didn't really do it. He just took all the credit, and that's why those guys were upset with him. And that could be true, that he, you know, was known to enjoy the public spotlight, whereas the two other gentlemen, like Kirby and Ditko, may have felt overlooked for the amount of work they were doing, and now this guy's getting all the credit. But I think it's important with what you said, is that when they left to do their own things, like Kirby, even when he went to DC in the 70s, created a whole new world with the Fourth World. But nobody looks back at those books and talks about how... not that the world isn't amazing, but they're wonky. There isn't any real, like... when he came, right? Am I... You know, do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you're coming from. So, like, I didn't care for the Fourth World stuff. It took me a long time to like it.
Right.
And now I love it, but it's not... It is very disjointed, and I don't... But I do know people who are maybe 5 to 10 years older than I am, who experienced it as it came out, and to them it was the biggest thing ever when Kirby went to DC. And he was creating this whole new world, and Darkseid, and all these characters. And it just... to me it falls flat... But there's something lifeless. I mean, it's very exciting. It's very technically great. I mean, definitely he's on the top of his game. His art is actually even better than it was.
Yes.
Than when he was working with Stan. But he was definitely exploring his creative boundaries.
Yes.
But I don't. It just doesn't appeal to me, personally.
Well, when he came back to Marvel afterwards, too, and was able to do Captain America and Black Panther on however, which he edited himself, scripted it himself. So basically, he was doing what he wanted to do originally with when he was collaborating with Stan. And I don't think any of those are fondly remembered, but in a different vein. Like, none of them are put on the list of, you know, this is the Captain America that you have to read, or the Black Panther that is the definitive version. Again, like you said, there's that term disjointed.
Yeah.
So I feel
it's sad, because I do have a tremendous amount of respect for Kirby, but as a kid at that time period, we were harsh on Kirby.
Right. A lot of people say that. Yeah.
I didn't care for. To be honest, anything Kirby in the 70s, I avoided like the plague. Aside from maybe Captain America, which was actually pretty good, but Machine Man. 2001, The Eternals. I thought The Eternals was ugly. I thought that artwork was just... It wasn't... The 70s artwork at Marvel was so different from the 60s artwork. And you could go back and say... Like, what I loved about characters like the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man was you go back and you read the Ditko stories, and it's like protozoical, or like... It's like ooze. It's like the protoplasm from which the character of Spider-Man... The polished Romita version came from. And I love those stories more than I like the Romita stuff. But it's... And the same thing with Fantastic Four. You can see it comes as kind of crude, and then it becomes shaped, and then it becomes the polished John Buscema classic. Like, almost... I'm not trying to think the right word, but it's almost like it should be in a museum. Mm. And then Kirby comes in, and again, it's all energy frenetic and Kirby Crackle and all the great things about his artwork, and it falls flat on a whole generation of kids that grew up reading different types of comics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we liked Ross Andrew, we liked Keith Pollard, we liked Jim Starlin. Those are the artists of the 70s that we liked in, at Marvel. And then, of course, you had Marshall Rogers and Jim Aparo and Neil Adams. Mm-hmm. Much more realistic-looking creators, realistic-looking art. So, yeah, it was kind of sad. I mean, that things didn't pick up. And then I think there was a real lack of respect at Marvel for Kirby at the time. They didn't.
Yeah.
He just kind of came in and dropped off his pages, and there wasn't the enthusiasm that there once was.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's a real testament to what Stan did for the culture of comics. Because, I mean, where would you put him amongst the pantheon of comic book writers or scripters even? Because if people are going to say that, you know, Ditko and Kirby and all these people were the ones who really did the storytelling, he just wrote in the dialogue, which is still very important, because later, like, there's some classic comic book artists who are now writing their own stuff and the dialogue is just not readable. So having right. very readable, smooth dialogue to transition the story is extremely important. But where would you put Stan Lee amongst, you know, the pantheon of comic book writers?
Oh, well, I mean, to me, there's no more important writer in comics than Stan Lee.
Yeah, it has to be, right?
Yeah.
It has to be.
I mean, he's the top. He's basically the king, and not just because he did write the stories, and he also was the editor, and he was also the carnival barker and the ringmaster, and he was the cheerleader out there getting people excited about the comics.
Right.
And speaking up on issues, too, in a time when, you know, the 60s were very divisive and DC was very conservative with their approach on things. And Stan was right there with the kids and listening to what was going on in college campuses. I mean, that's the part of the heart of the big Ditko's feud is the fact that he and Stan were so far apart politically.
Yes.
On
yes.
things. So Stan was very much like, yeah, kids and college and fight for your rights and stand up to the man and no, let's make love, not war, all that stuff. And Ditko was like, yes, you know, support your government, you know, or let's have Peter Parker say, snarky things about the people with the student protests. And Stan was like changing the dialogue to be, oh, I completely get where they're coming from, and making it positive comments about the protesting, and that would drive Ditko up the wall. He'd be like, "That's not what I wrote."
Right. This is my guy. He's a black and white type of character. Why are you messing mm-hmm. with it? Yeah.
So I mean, to me, there is no greater run in comics than Amazing Spider-Man 1-38 and the two annuals. To me, those are the most perfect comic collection you could possibly have. So you take that, omnibus, the Amazing Spider-Man Volume 1 omnibus. I would take that with me to my grave as the greatest comics ever made. But that's just me, of course. But the Fantastic Four is right up there as well, and so forth.
And that's the thing. Some people would say the 100 issues of Jack and Stan doing Fantastic Four is up there. Like, these are monumental runs that he had on books that some people don't have nowadays. 20 issue runs on a comic book,
right?
Yeah.
And it was a big deal when he left those books because they were so intertwined with him. You know, Kirby and was very much involved in FF and with Thor, Thor in particular. So that when he left, it was a big deal. But and then Stan kept going on. I mean, Stan did another 100 issues with Jack. Actually, they did 102 issues. And then he did 100 issues of Spider-Man as well with different collaborators.
Yeah. And it stayed consistently good even after Ditko left. Like, that's one of the great things about the Stan staying on that book was, yeah, Romita was phenomenal and Gil Kane and I think Buscema was on that first 100 issue run. But Stan's voice, like, you hear his voice when you read that dialogue, and there's something special about that as a kid that you have that connection to the person making it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the characters of Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane and Peter Parker and his crew, it's Stan. Yeah. To me, that's Stan speaking out. It's not, you know, Romita made them very pretty, but the Mary Jane was a product of Stan.
Right.
And his imagination.
And all of the catchphrases that he had, like, how many catchphrases do they still use in comics that were written by Stan, right? Like, face the tiger, you hit the jackpot, or face front, true believers, mm-hmm. like, Avengers Assemble. I mean, come mm-hmm. on. It's endless, and we still say them today.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I just had a thought in my head, and it was just, do you think, and I think we both know the answer to this, but would there even be the culture in comic books fandom without Stan Lee? Because, you know, Julie Schwartz was the editor on the DC side, but you didn't know what he looked like. You didn't know what he sounded like. He didn't make a community for anyone who was a DC comic book fan the way Stan did for Marvel.
No, I don't think we'd have comics fandom the way it is without Stan Lee. I think that there definitely were fans of the Justice League and the DC characters. But I could definitely have seen the comic industry fizzling out around 1970 if it wasn't for Stan Lee making them relevant to fans.
Yeah.
And then breaking those boundaries. I mean, when I look at, you know, what he was doing with Marvel pushed DC to do things out of their comfort zone.
Yes, definitely.
And you know, Denny O'Neil was able to do a lot of really great comics with Neil Adams over at DC, like Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and their run on Detective with Detective Comics and Batman. It's, you know, they took them out of their zone and they started to create comics more like Stan.
Yeah.
And I think when you look at DC's attempt to revive their entire line in 1985 with Crisis.
Yeah.
They took the most Marvel-like book that they were publishing, which was New Teen Titans.
Yep.
Which was basically George Perez and Marv Wolfman, both of who had made their names with Len Wein along the way.
Yep.
All of who had been big Marvel guys at one point in the 70s, taking that formula and applying it to a DC book, and the fandom followed.
Yes, absolutely.
And so with Crisis, they changed the whole line, of course. But they brought in John Byrne, Frank Miller, you know, all these guys who were big Marvel creators and got them to fix DC's model.
Marvelize it almost.
Mm-hmm. Add that continuity level that was missing.
Yeah.
Because before that, you'd pick up Batman, and Batman was kind of, there was some continuity to Batman, but most of the issues were self-contained, and you could, you know, their thinking was, you know, they wanted to be able to have any kid pick up the issue and know what was going on. It was Batman. Everyone was familiar with him. Same thing with Superman. There would be no long-form storylines, no real continuity with the back. You know, you knew Perry White, Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen, those characters were in the background. But they didn't have long continuing storylines with them. Like, Jimmy Olsen wasn't, you know, taking drugs and, mm-hmm. you know, falling down holes and having to be saved and things like that. He would just have the occasional issue where he turned into, like, Turtle Boy or you know, brought Superman to a gorilla for some reason. And they'd have fights. But it was kind of quaint. It was like kiddie comics.
Yeah.
The DC comics were more for kids.
Yeah.
Than the Marvel books. Marvel books were for the serious connoisseurs, you know, the true fans of comics. So I'm sort of going, okay, I'm a, what can I say? I'm a Marvel zombie. I'm of the 70s.
Yeah, sure. I'm going back now. I'm more of a retro reader now with all of the collections that come out. And I grew up, you know, a DC comic fan first because I love Superman and Batman and all that kind of stuff. And I felt like those were the original superheroes. And growing up, I used to kind of throw shade at Stan Lee, saying, you know, he was just throwing things at the wall and nobody's origin really made any sense. It was all science experiment gone wrong. Like, it was just shortcuts that he would take to come up with different stuff. But the Superman I like was John Byrne's Superman. That was a Superman that I enjoyed. Then I start to realize all the things I'm liking about DC are things that Marvel started. Like, they come from the Marvel Universe in the sense of flawed characters and creating a world that, you know, ancillary characters that matter to you. And the continuity, those were the things that were appealing to me. And now I go back and read, like you said, 70s Marvel stuff. And I've been just reading Marvel for the last year, it seems. And, you know, a lot of that, you got to look back and say, Stan Lee, even the television shows I'm watching, like Daredevil, I know it's very heavily influenced by Frank Miller's rendition, but that's another character that Stan Lee came up with. Just incredible decade that he had.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of, I mean, sometimes other people come to him with those characters, and then he would develop them, or some I don't think ever really hit their stride, understand, like the X-Men. But, you know,
The concept is there.
And like Daredevil, it's all there. I was never a fan of Daredevil as a kid, and I think part of it was I was never a huge fan of Gene Colan until much later. So I find that the stories are a little bit more crime oriented. They're more about people doing things as opposed to supervillains.
Right.
And so that wasn't what I was attracted to as a reader. And I've since been reading them, and they're great. But they're great stories about humanity and struggles, and racism, and overcoming odds. And I think a lot of the Daredevil Netflix series does draw from Frank Miller's interpretations and Brian Michael Bendis' interpretations and Ed Brubaker's interpretations and so forth that we got over the last, you know, the early 2000s.
Right.
So, but I still, I mean, Miller's run on Daredevil was outstanding, and that was that connection. I mean, he was a crime fan who became a comic creator who eventually took on Daredevil, took it to being the second best-selling, or at times the best-selling title on the rack. And then he went to DC and he fixed Batman, essentially, with Year One and with Dark Knight Returns. He basically reminded everybody about why they love Batman.
Right, right.
And, I mean, and Batman's a great character. I love Batman. I mean, in fact, I love the Golden Age Batman comics. And I've gone back to revisit them, and they were, again, that kind of like that. To me, the early Batman stories are like the early Ditko Spider-Mans. They're like crude. You can sort of see them becoming the character that you eventually love. But they're, the stuff in the 50s is fun in a different way. It's different types of comics. And I think one of the things I liked about being introduced to comics through Marvel and then through DC and then through indies is you see the variety of storytelling methods. Right. And so I love comics in general because I was exposed to something that was so good I wanted to seek out other types of good comics. And I don't just want the same thing. I don't just want another hackneyed retread Spider-Man issue every month.
Right.
I would rather seek out something really good by someone who's talented, who may not be working for Marvel Comics, who may be working for Image Comics or something like that.
Right.
But
so do you have a favorite Stan Lee story that he wrote, like a comic book story? Is there one for you that is your standout one?
Well, I mean, the Spider-Man stuff in particular I love. AF-15, the first Spider-Man story. I love the Master Planeter trilogy, that whole issue 36 when he's, or 33 I should say, or whatever it is, when he's trapped under the rubble.
Right.
And he's trying to struggle to get himself out. To me, that's quintessential Spider-Man. Spider-Man No More in issue 50 is a great one. There's a lot there. I mean, do I have a favorite? I mean, I could say I have a favorite story with a character by Stan. In each case, I mean, I have a very fond spot for Spider-Man 18, which was the first Silver Age comic I bought. And that's Spider-Man is basically he's hiding. He's on the run. He ran away from fight in the previous issue, and the world thinks he's a coward. And Aunt May is sick, and he doesn't want to risk his life until he knows she's out of the woods. And so he runs from a fight from the Sandman. He's thinking about quitting. To me, that's inspirational. It's like even superheroes have bad days.
Yeah.
And that was something I never got from DC Comics, where usually the superheroes were perfect.
Yeah.
And they always solved the problem, and they had maybe a little bit of a fight or a physical challenge, but because they were the superior being, or they had superior morality, they would win. I don't think necessarily Spider-Man has superior morality. I think he just is a good person that overcomes odds. And to me, that's the type of person I would want to be.
Yeah, I think Stan's creations, the type of characters he made, were, like you said, aspirational characters that were so much more human. Even with superhuman abilities, they were having fun being heroes, but were also tortured by the gifts that they had been given. And it's a human experience. All his characters had that same human experience that we have, whereas I think in the DC world, it was just a great imagination to have a power ring. Like, what would that be like? It was almost, you know, the having a genie as your friend to be a DC character. Whereas in the Marvel
universe,
Go
ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say something controversial, sort of controversial. I was going to say that without Stan Lee in Marvel Comics, we would not have Star Wars.
I don't think that's controversial. Why is that controversial?
Okay, I don't know, because some people love Star Wars so much that
I think all
they
of
believe
those,
it came fully formed.
No, I think all of those things that came post, like in the 70s, all of the things that we began to love were people who loved Marvel Comics, but they couldn't make that stuff. It just wasn't going to be accepted in media the way it is today. And I think finally what happened, and it's only fitting, that the stuff that Stan and Jack and Steve and all of those guys from that decade of the 60s that's on the screen that is enduring are the stuff that they made. And it's the highest selling movies ever for a reason. Because I think people have been trying to make those things, but they could never put people in costume because it looks silly.
Right. Well, I think they said at one point the technology finally caught up to Jack Kirby's imagination.
Exactly.
And there's no doubt there's a formula to, you know, and we talk about this with the movies too. You look at the Marvel movies and the DC movies, and there's a joy and a camaraderie and a fun element to the Marvel movies that you lack in the DC movies, which are somber and in some cases very dark.
Ugh.
And kind of depressing. It's like there's no humanity in the mix.
It's almost like they're trying to make some sort of a religious commentary in the DC universe, where I don't find that that's as much the case in the Marvel universe, even though you're fighting Thanos, which there are, you know, you can make those comparisons to God in a character like Thanos, but you don't leave feeling as dreary as you do with the DC stuff. And I think that's a large part because of like that Stan Lee infusion, that energy is there. Maybe I'm thinking nostalgically because of, you know, remembering Stan, but I think that's a big reason for it.
Well, I think you look at, and the actors have got it. I mean, in most of the cases, most of the major actors in the Marvel movies, they've captured what they think Stan brought to each of those characters and what Jack, of course, visually brought to the table. But I think about, like, Captain America, right? So Stan didn't create Captain America, and he only wrote a few Captain America stories. But I think of Chris Evans as Captain America. Of course, he's a paragon of morality, but he also goes through a journey.
Yeah.
And he's not perfect, but he stands by his opinion. And I think standing by his opinion and not just being the mouth of the military is more of a Stan thing than the Jack thing. So yeah, I think the Jack Kirby, Joe Simon, Captain America was rah rah America, we're gonna win, we're, you know, that greatest generation stuff. And then I think the Stan Lee Captain America was more like, am I an extension of my country or am I an extension of my values?
Yes.
And he basically stands up for his values first and foremost, and that might put him at odds with his government. But first and foremost, he's there to protect the individual and the fact that America is about freedom of pursuit of your dreams, pursuit of your liberty, all those things that, and then of course Thor, there's an arrogance there with Thor and a brag, you know, he's a bit of a braggart, and he talks with a high, like a bit of an English accent and, and yeah. language you might not hear anywhere else, and he's a fish out of water, and but he's a big, lovable guy who supports his friends, and all those things are there in the 60s Thor comics.
Yeah.
You know, he's noble, and he stands up, and he believes strongly in his family, and but he also stands up for people, first and foremost. He's a protector of humanity. And so a lot of that, you know, a lot of that is on the screen, too. So when you start playing around, you can tell great stories with Marvel books where you can completely destroy the foundation on which those characters stand, and they still come out on top as the, you know, it's not the place that makes the character, it's the character in the place.
Right.
And the place becomes part of the character, as opposed to, you could destroy Asgard and Thor is still Thor.
Right.
And, you know, anyway, but that's a lot of the Stan stuff, I think, too, that's kind of that infusion of character.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay, two more questions before we wrap this up. What is your favorite Stan Lee cameo in a Marvel movie?
My favorite Stan Lee cameo in a movie might be Guardians of the Galaxy 2. When he's on the planet with the Watchers.
Yeah.
And he's going, oh, and then there was a time I was a FedEx delivery guy. My favorite comedy Stan Lee one might be The Amazing Spider-Man.
In the library?
Yeah, in the library with but that, to me, that's a lot of very derivative of the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Right. That's right.
But it's still great. Spider-Man 3, not a great movie, but Stan's cameo, Peter's looking at a billboard and he walks up to him and he says, you know what? I guess one person really can make a difference.
Yeah. That's a good
one. And then on Sheer Joy, his Teen Titans Go cameo. I don't know if you've seen that.
I haven't seen that one.
And the movie came out. It's just basically the Teen Titans are on a movie lot. And then in the background, you see an old guy with a broom. And he stops and looks at the camera. And then he smiles. And you see him looking like around the characters. He's like, what's going on here? And then he grabs him and he says, hey, I'm Stan Lee. It's time for my Stan Lee cameo. I love cameos. This is my favorite thing. I don't even care if this is a DC movie. I just love cameos. And to me, that's Stan. He just loves doing that kind of stuff, like being out there with people and having fun with it.
And it always makes people happier seeing him in the movie too, right? You're always waiting for that moment. And it was always a highlight to see him show up.
Yes.
My favorite was the same as yours, the Guardians
of the Galaxy. And I know
I think we're lagging.
What's your favorite?
I said Guardians of the Galaxy 2. That was my favorite as well. It was, it's kind of the way I'm always going to think of Stan now. Because there was those rumors that he was the Watcher, you know, of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So I thought that was a perfect cameo. I interrupted you, Kevin. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I'm curious to see where... I mean, I know he's filmed a few cameos, so he'll definitely be there. The Stan that we know will be in Captain Marvel and Avengers 4, and probably in Spider-Man as well. And I know he's recorded dialogue for his cameos in Wreck-It Ralph 2 and Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh, okay, that's great. That's great.
And then a few years ago, we were after Powers, and we were with Stan's manager at the time, and he said, so Stan, you wouldn't believe it, like Stan actually went and Marvel had him do full scans. So they've done full computer scans of Stan's body and voice tests and things like that. So they have they've basically created, or they have on file, enough information to create a digital Stan Lee for future cameos.
Fantastic. That's great.
And like, unless his daughter says no, he can't do it or something like that, I think it was his wish that they continue including him in Marvel movies even after he was gone.
That's great.
But I think he was a little depressed when it actually happened.
Sure.
So that night he came back and said, "Oh man, does this mean they're giving up on me and that I'm going to die?" And I think his manager said, "Listen, Stan, you're going to go in forever, as far as I know. Like, it's going to be you and Keith Richards and the Cockroaches. You're going to be like the last man on earth."
Yeah. Yeah, and I would have believed it too if that would have happened. Mm-hmm. Stanley and Keith Richards. So what is your favorite or the one thing you're most grateful to Stanley for?
I think it's that sense of community that we talk about. And I think that sense of community is what's helped drive us forward for the last few decades. As I think the publishing wing we've endured some issues with distribution and with sales, and now with issues of comic book stores are struggling, and it's not because the material isn't good. I think it's just because Stanley's ideas have moved beyond the comic book page.
Yeah.
And they're now on the movie screens and on TV screens and in video games and all sorts of other pop culture. It's almost saying that the world now accepts what we love as being the mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, like when the late night comedians all joke about, if you can throw out a superhero name and everybody in the audience knows who that is and gets your point of your joke, you know that you've made it. Your comics are mainstream now.
Yeah.
And we all grew up in some level with comics in part of our life. I'm not sure if the next generations of kids do. To them, Spider-Man is a movie character or a video game character or a cartoon character. He's not a comic book character. It's not something that they read about. Like, we used to read about Spider-Man and imagine what his adventures are like. Now you can throw him in your PlayStation 4 and play him for 4 hours and web around the city and get into trouble and do all these things. So there's definitely that element to it.
Yeah.
I think that he's definitely, Stan definitely was able to, he came to California in the 70s to make Marvel part of pop culture, and he succeeded beyond his expectations.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was thinking about it. Oh, go ahead.
No, let's go ahead. I interrupted you.
There's a lag on this thing. My apologies to the listener. I was going to say, I was thinking about it today, and I don't think what I do for a hobby or, you know, some of my happiest moments now in my downtime, I wouldn't experience them if not for Stan Lee. And that's, you know, that's not hyperbole. It's we wouldn't have this comic book community. We wouldn't be talking the many times that we have if it wasn't for what he did and championed when, you know, it was, he comes from the era where people were embarrassed to be comic book writers. Now it's a lot of people's dreams to just talk about comic books. And I think that's a lot, that's part and parcel to Stan Lee. That's, I think, his biggest contribution above everything else. And Spider-Man is like my favorite thing. So that says a lot for what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed. I mean, I also think he changed the nature of the convention business.
Sure.
Because, I think back to when we offered Stan a lot of money to come to the Toronto show. And it was unheard of, that amount of money that we offered. And now that's nothing. I mean, he would come and he would make a lot of money at conventions because people love him and people wanted to get his autograph. People want to get his photograph. And now it's become more of a thing where, up until that point, creators did not charge for their autographs. They would come and they would meet the fans and we'd fly them in and take care of them. And there was no charges involved, and they would make their money selling comics or doing sketches or whatever the case is. But now people charge for their autographs. There's the collectability of comics has expanded into things like CGC. I would say Stan Lee almost single-handedly built the CGC Signature Series label. Because, you know, like when I started working on that, and I was the first Signature Series director for CGC. And, people would get, at that point, it was like a keepsake. You went to the convention, you met your favorite comic creator, and you got a comic signed and went from there. Now, when Stan came into the mix, everybody pulled out their classic Silver Age comics and said, I need to get my Amazing Fantasy 15 signed. I need to get my Spider-Man 1 signed and encapsulated with the Signature Series label on it. And then those prices started going up. And then, you know, an encapsulated Signature Series Stan Lee Amazing Spider-Man 1 would fetch you another $1,000 above what the guide value price was. So there was definitely that mixture of, I want to get this because, I mean, who knows how long Stan will be around. But also this whole collectability, like, it's adding more to the value of the book. And so, you know, when Stan would do a show, he would sign hundreds of comics for Signature Series. And people paid a lot of money for that option.
Yeah. Well, there's a significance of it too, right, of what he wrote. Like, his a lot of the stuff that he wrote was significant because it was trailblazing. It wasn't just a variant cover or you know, a rare cover that you need to order 200 copies of some other title to get. It was just because people loved the story. That's what the significance of a Stan Lee book.
Well, and the other thing, too, and there were a lot of debates, too. Stan signed any Marvel comic because he was seen as the... in a sense, he was, because he was the editor who started the Marvel line. He was the writer that reintroduced the superheroes with Kirby and with Ditko and Don Heck and those people. So he's there. He's like, if anyone is the father of Marvel Comics,
definitely.
You know, Stan Lee is there. I mean, you can also say that Kirby is the father of Marvel Comics, and you wouldn't be wrong. But I think people took odds initially at the fact that Stan signed anything Marvel, including characters that, you know,
he didn't create. Yeah,
he had nothing to do with. You know, like Stan Lee has nothing to do with Wolverine. He didn't create him. He did create the X-Men, but Wolverine was created by other people, and he debuted in a Marvel comic, and he was brought into the X-Men, written by other people. So, but that doesn't mean that Wolverine doesn't come from that protoplasm of Marvel Comics.
Oh, definitely.
And he fits right in.
He's a mutant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
So it's just, you know, one of those things. You know, Stan is, the fact he's gone is going to take a hard time for most of us to get around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the fact that this week in particular, I see it as like, you know, there are different types of funerals, right? There's the, oh, you know, they lived a long life and I respect them and I, you know, they're a great person and I hope they're in a better place. And then there's the, oh, they suffered and their suffering is at an end now and so forth. But Stan Lee loved life and loved everybody pretty much right up to the end.
Right.
And even with some troubles he had, he still tried to move beyond that. And you know, when people would go visit him and they would see the old Stan come out. We're sorry to see him go. I'm sure he's sorry to be gone. I'm sure he's happy to be reunited with his wife if there's an afterlife. Someone was like, my late partner, Deborah, was a huge fan of Stan. And they interacted on many occasions at conventions. And so someone said, like, oh, I bet you she's getting hugs from him right now. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure there's like a line a mile along. Now mm-hmm. that Stan Lee's in heaven, I'm sure there's just as many people who want to meet him up there mm-hmm. as wanted to meet him at a convention. So, you know, I don't know if they have autograph lines and photo ops in heaven, but if there are, then Stan Lee is right now open for business.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great to be able to look back and smile and be grateful for all the things that, like, he definitely made millions of kids through so many decades' lives that much better, whether it's a Saturday afternoon or Saturday morning cartoon, comic books, conventions, video games, and now the movies. It's just, I say to people, you know, he's more important to pop culture than pretty much anybody that we can think of. And I would say even more than Walt Disney. Even though Disney owns Marvel, his contributions to it surpass pretty much all of those people that we can think of in the last 100 years?
Well, my boss was fond of saying that Stan was... There are very few people like Walt Disney in the world that created empires.
Right.
And carved out stuff. And Stan Lee was one of those people. And I don't disagree with him. I completely agree that Stan Lee... It's just unfortunate. Stan Lee was not the master of his domain, as Walt Disney was. Stan was an employee. Right. And so as a result, he had to carve out his legacy from being Stan Lee.
Yeah.
You know, from writing comics and from interacting with fans. And I would say that the real sadness will be 10 years from now when a lot of people who had never had a chance to meet him have no perspective on what Stan Lee was like.
Yeah.
That, I think, will be the sad part of it when we start moving away from that. And I really do think that we're, you know, who is the next Stan Lee? There is no next Stan Lee.
No, absolutely not.
Not at the moment.
No, I can't think.
I mean, there are great comic creators who I love, who will definitely fill some of that void, but there is no person that is universally loved, or in some cases revolved, but mostly loved, like Stan was.
Yeah, no, there'll never be another, no question.
You know, so, you know, Neil Adams and Frank Miller and Todd McFarlane and others will be fondly remembered and maybe even step up in some cases to fill that void. There's an exuberance to Todd that I think he brings to the table that is kind of influenced by Stan. The fact he just loves comics and loves talking about them.
Yeah, Rob Liefeld's like that too.
Rob Liefeld as well. You know, Neil Adams is definitely he's the statesman.
Yes.
For comics.
Yes.
Very smart, but doesn't endear that same love. It's more like respect. Respect Neil Adams.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
But you love Stan Lee.
He was everyone's grandfather.
And yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Except for those couple people that wrote some really crappy eulogies.
Yeah.
Couple of articles I read where they really decided, oh, I think I'll take some shots at Stan. And you know, in my opinion, there's no point in taking shots at Stan for Jack. Jack's work stands out for himself. He's a great artist, and his legacy is not in doubt, nor is Stan's. I think there's the... they both even recognized that together they were greater than individually.
Yeah.
So I think we do, you know, they may have hard feelings from some things where they skirmished, but that's between them. We don't need to act like children of divorce anymore now that both parents are gone.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good way to put it.
Because usually, you know, in a divorce, you side with one parent over the other, and really both were trying, and it's unfortunate. Sometimes one's worse than the other, but...
But we owe so much to both of them, right? That's, at the end of the day, that's the one thing that we can't argue. We owe it to them for what we are able to enjoy now, and we just got to celebrate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, there you go. Thanks, Kevin. This was a nice chat to be able to reflect back and share some good memories about Stan Lee and put into perspective. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. It's always fun talking about Stan. I you know, just from my experiences with him, which were, all my interactions were interesting, and always fun stuff happened around Stan at conventions when I saw him. But, you know, even if I'd never met him, I love his work. I love his comics. I love his contributions. And the Marvel comics that I grew up with, and I owe him a lot.
Yeah, and thank you for being part of the crew that was bringing him here year after year. These you know, up until 2016, because a lot of us got to see him and hear him speak, and you even saw young kids be able to ask him questions, and his interaction with them was really special. So you know, you're a part of that community too, that made other people get to enjoy Stan Lee.
Well, I'm happy to. I enjoy that part of my job. I like connecting great creators with people,
right,
and fans, and having that interaction. And I think we had so many fun events over the years. Like the first time Stan came to Toronto, we had an event in a bar. And basically, everybody was having pints of beer, and Stan would just walk to tables and, "How's everybody?" and have a pint, make jokes about how pretty the girls were behind the bar, and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And then, you know, the Stanley breakfasts were always a lot of fun.
Yeah.
At all the different shows and stuff. So there's definitely there's something there. And, you know, we do try to do some things like that with different creators at different shows. I have an experience. I think Stan Lee added the experience level of coming to a con. I think before Stan Lee, we didn't really have these kinds of VIP experiences where you could go and have lunch with Stan Lee or go to a bar and have a drink with Stan Lee or, you know, interact on that kind of level too. Go to a special room and get your comic signed and listen to stories and things like that. You'd said it was all personal. It was like, I liked your comics. I went up, I would get them signed. I would ask you a question or two. I'd be kind of nervous. I'd maybe listen to you in a panel and then I go on my way.
Right.
And Stan added that, oh, I got to go get a ticket to go see him at the special Stan Lee breakfast. And he would tell jokes and it would be, you're part of a special group. Like a small group of fans, super fans that, and anybody was welcome, of course, but it wasn't like an exclusive thing. But it was in a sense, you know, you put yourself into this elite group of people that got to see Stan at this event at this level and have breakfast with him and fight with him over a piece of toast. you know, little things like that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thanks, Kevin, for doing this and giving us so much of your time.
Yeah, no problem, Eric. It's always fun. That's the one thing, too. Stan was fun, and I can't get maudlin about Stan. I can't get weepy and so forth. I can a little bit, but, like, I think Stan was always like, let's have fun. It's comics.
Yeah.
It's not – we're not talking about, you know, the really bad stuff. And, of course, there's bad stuff and we can share in comics but and fight against injustice. But, you know, let's have fun. Let's you know, crack jokes. Let's be – like, Stan is so much like Spider-Man.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Quips and jokes and lightening the mood and just making life fun.
Yeah, even when you're having a fight, crack a joke. It might make it a little bit better.
Yeah. Yep. Lighten up the atmosphere. And it might even drive the person even crazier, but as it did with all his villains. But anyway.
That's so great. Well, thanks, Kevin.
You know, I guess one person can make the difference. Enough said.